Welcome to the 14th year of Food for Thought podcast, the place to explore, celebrate, and manifest a life motivated and defined by unconditional compassion and optimal wellness. My name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau. I'm your host. I'm the author of The Joy of Vegan Baking, The Vegan Table, Color Me Vegan, Vegan's Daily Companion, The 30-Day Vegan Challenge, and my most recent book, The Joyful Vegan, How to Stay Vegan in a World That Wants You to Eat Meat, Dairy, and Eggs. You can find me at joyfulvegan.com. You can find me at ColleenPatrickGoudreau.com. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And thank you very much for tuning in and subscribing to Food for Thought. You can do so at iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and wherever you listen to podcast. I think it should be called Stitcher Play. Thank you for sharing this podcast with others. I can't tell you how much it means to me to read your ratings and reviews. And of course, thank you so much for supporting it. Food for Thought is a 100% listener-supported podcast. So please become a supporter today at patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGoudreau to support this work. And thank you so much in advance. You can also join me around the world traveling vegan style. Go to cpgtrips.com. Just type in vegan trips with Colleen Patrick-Goudreau. You can see them on my website. We've got some great current trips that we're running, sold out of a couple. And of course, for future trips, you can join the mailing list. We do have a couple spots left in France. We just had a cancellation. So unfortunately for them, and fortunately for you, we've got some room and we will be scouting Italy after that trip. Not all over Italy, but we will be scouting an Italy trip. Northern Italy, we're looking at Umbria and Tuscany as well. And we've got lots of trips up our sleeves. So join us now or join the mailing list. And finally, if you're interested in where I'll be appearing for talks and book signings, go to appearances or events at my website. And I look forward to seeing you in person. Today's topic is why vegan? Pick a reason. Hello, everyone. So good to be here with you. I have been guiding people to becoming and staying vegan for 20 years now, and I can say without a doubt that people want this information. I can say without a doubt that I think people do want to make a change, but of course they're resistant. And let's face it, I think they're afraid. They're afraid of the unknown. They're afraid they're going to be missing out on something. They're afraid of all the things they're told to be afraid of: nutrient deficiencies, inconvenience, higher cost, social awkwardness, pushback from family and friends. They're afraid of sticking out from the crowd. They're afraid of new foods or unsatisfying foods and products, name it. What I've tried to do all these years is to dispel the myths, to acknowledge these challenges and fears and concerns, and then guide people through them and give them the tools and resources that will empower them to make changes that reflect their values and that also make them feel joyful while doing it, and so that they can feel that it's sustainable and it's doable. Now, I've often said that I believe people struggle most with the how vegan, which is why I've written 7 books and continue to produce this podcast. It's why I travel and speak to live audiences. It's why I make these videos to help people with the how. When it comes to the why, vegan, I always say pick a reason, any reason, and it alone would be enough to justify eating a plant-based diet. And so I thought it would be helpful to put all that in one place. We don't have an episode. In over 14 years, we don't have an episode that puts all of it in one place, all of those reasons that justify leaving animal flesh and fluids behind and eating a diet based on fruits and vegetables, grains, beans, mushrooms, lentils, nuts, seeds, all of it, right? I think most vegans will tell you that they probably became vegan for one reason. There was one thing that sparked their desire to be vegan, but they remain vegan for a number of reasons. And actually, the data do show that the more reasons you have and the more that you identify with, the better your chances are of staying vegan and staying vegan joyfully and sustainably. Now, there are as many reasons not to eat animals as there are lives that could be saved by making this simple change. And that's billions, but we don't have time to list billions. So I'm going to focus on a few. Some people choose to stop eating animals and animal products to experience health benefits or to reverse a particular illness or ailment. Some people don't want to contribute to violence against animals or to pay people to work in an industry that necessarily desensitizes them to animal suffering and thus to their own compassion. Aware of the devastating effects of animal agriculture on the environment, some people are moved to help prevent global warming or global depletion in general. With precious rainforests disappearing in order to create grazing land for cattle that will be killed, wild animals are killed at the behest of private ranchers, and of course we know that precious resources, water, food, and energy are being poured into what is an unsustainable system. So people kind of have that idea that they know that eliminating animal products from their lives is indeed a logical and sensible response. But of course, as I said, fear plays a huge role. The unknown plays a huge role for people. Now, I personally enjoy many health benefits from being vegan. I have very high energy. I always have, but it continues to sustain at this level. And I am about to cross a milestone birthday. I enjoy low cholesterol. I have normal blood pressure. You know, all of the things that people will talk about that typically happen when you're not eating animal products. But I did become, and I do remain vegan because I don't want to contribute to violence against animals, even though I love the health benefits. So there are multiple reasons. Upon becoming vegan, I immediately and unexpectedly felt a tremendous amount of peace, knowing that the suffering of animals bred and killed for food no longer has anything to do with me. It's still happening. I didn't stop it. There's not like 10 million fewer animals killed because I stopped eating them, but it was the right thing to do. And that feels really good. I remember feeling that a huge weight just fell off of my shoulders. And although I didn't expect that, I did not expect it. I can say that when that happened, I just experienced just a sense of serenity and clarity that I just really didn't plan for. My choices have increased, my perception has broadened, and my values have been strengthened. You know, frankly, that's reason enough. End of podcast. There you go. Like, living according to our values is reason enough. So I didn't expect it, but I have found no experience to be as profound as living my life in such a way that celebrates life, that celebrates my values, and that seeks to live as nonviolently, consciously, simply, and healthfully as possible. That does bring me great joy, and I experience that every day. So pick a reason. Maybe that's your reason. Any reason alone would be good enough to justify eating an animal-free diet. Whether you care about human rights, food safety, wild animals, the environment, world hunger, farmed animals, or your own health, just a cursory look at each social issue demonstrates how intricately linked they are to our consumption of animal-based meat, dairy, and eggs. Let's start with food safety. From age-old scourges such as smallpox and tuberculosis to threats like AIDS and SARS, and right now what we're experiencing in the coronavirus, our interactions with, our farming of, and our consumption of animals have always played a pivotal role as a source of human disease. We know the start of coronavirus was, we know exactly where it started, and it was at a live animal market. Right? This is not news to anybody who knows the connection between human disease and animal disease, because we humans are animals. We are animals, and we are physiologically similar to other animals. We're susceptible to the wide range of bacteria, parasites, viruses that infect the animals we eat. Now, plant foods are also subjected to exposure to bacteria and parasites and other infectious agents, but the biochemical makeup of plants is so different from ours that the microorganisms that infect them don't affect us, right? The microorganisms, I will say this again, it's a little pull quote. The microorganisms that infect plants do not affect humans. That's why you will never meet a person with Dutch elm disease or aphids. If a plant food does contain an organism that threatens human health, then it's most certainly a contaminant from an animal source, usually through feces contaminated irrigation water or feces from an animal who defecated directly on a crop. Most of the time, it's through some kind of animal agriculture system. Unfortunately, whenever there's an outbreak of a foodborne illness that gets traced back to a plant crop, the media stops short of telling the whole whole story, that an infected animal is what contaminated the plant crop in the first place. More than 250 diseases are transmitted through food. And these infectious microorganisms include, you can name some yourself, Salmonella, Trichinella, Toxoplasmosis, parasites, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, aka people call it BSE or mad cow disease, hepatitis viruses, and cancer viruses. In fact, many of the major killer pandemics we've been plagued with, and no pun intended, were acquired from our contact with non-human animals, such as tuberculosis from cattle, influenza from pigs and birds, whooping cough from pigs and dogs, smallpox from cattle. Even HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, is believed to have been first transmitted to humans through the butchering and consumption of infected chimpanzees. Many cases go undiagnosed and some are fatal. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the United States, the CDC estimates 48 million people get sick, 128,000 are hospitalized, and 3,000 die from foodborne illnesses each year in the United States. Doesn't sound like a lot to you? Well, I wouldn't want to be one of those 3,000, especially when it's preventable like so many of our diseases are. Operating within the status quo of our meat, dairy, and egg-based culture, the experts suggest that we take care of the problem by washing our hands, by keeping separate cutting boards for animal products and vegetables, and cooking meat and eggs in order to ostensibly kill the pathogens. Well, here's news, that doesn't happen. Many of the pathogens don't die just from being cooked. They may as well tell you to put your left foot in, put your left foot out, put your left foot in and shake it all about, because that would do just about as much good. Nonetheless, we're told to cook our meat thoroughly, but not too much. Cook it too little and you risk a bacterial infection. Cook it too much and you risk serving cancer-causing substances to your children. I don't know about you, but it seems to me just logically that the easiest solution is to just not eat this stuff at all, not bring it into your home especially, because otherwise you're crossing your fingers, saying a prayer, hoping we scrubbed our cutting board well enough to kill Salmonella, Campylobacter, Listeria, E. coli, or anthrax. Like, no problem. But like, if we just ate, you know, cruelty-free, disease-preventing, and health-promoting plant foods that don't have the same pathogens as animal products, animal flesh and fluids, that seems to be a logical solution. The problem isn't vegetables, and the problem isn't how we raise animals for their flesh and fluids. The problem is that we raise animals for their flesh and fluids. And of course, by extension, the problem is that we eat animal flesh and fluids. When humans began domesticating cattle and pigs and sheep and goats and eventually chickens and turkeys, thousands of years ago, it meant that we lived in close proximity with animals, breathing, eating, and drinking their germs. Of course, the gatekeepers of the media would argue that it would be biased even to suggest that eating only plants would reduce your risk of foodborne illness. The implication is that eating meat and other animal products is neutral. Like, promoting eating animal flesh and fluids is neutral, but not eating animal flesh and fluids, like that, like promoting that, that's political, or that's taking a position, or that's being biased. And all the while, the public scratches their heads, washes their hands, and makes scapegoats of the green leafy vegetables. And so it will continue until policy is changing and someone is brave enough in the government, in the media, to talk about the fact that the worst thing you might find in a vegan kitchen is aphids in your kale and a boar worm in your corn, neither of which pose a health risk. So that's the first reason to eat only plants and stop eating animal flesh and fluids: pathogens from animal products, zoonotic diseases. Reason number one, reason enough. But there's more. Next, why vegan? Wild animals on the land and in the sea. People who say they care nothing for farmed animals, and I think that people do, especially once they see them in relationship with other animals and with other people. I think just most of us have not seen farmed animals in those situations, and to really see their personalities and their individuality and their relationships with one another and their commonalities with us. But those who say, no, I don't care about pigs, that's what they're here for, that's why we bring them into this world, I think they would declare that they love wildlife, that they do love wild animals, that they love watching the birds outside, they love seeing the deer, they love seeing, you know, sea turtles, like whatever it is. Most people would say they really enjoy watching wildlife. And what they may not know is that animals in the wild, both on land and in the sea, suffer immensely and die prematurely and often gruesomely because of our insatiable appetite for the bodies and secretions of domesticated animals. For nearly a century, the U.S. federal government has been involved in wildlife killing campaigns designed to protect ranchers. And I know many other countries deal with this as well. Obviously, this is U.S.-centric, but many other countries do the same thing. The U.S. Department of Agriculture-led program Animal Damage Control, which is now euphemistically called Wildlife Services, spends millions of tax dollars each year to kill millions of coyotes, wolves, bears, mountain lions, birds, and many other animals as a subsidy for the agricultural and livestock industries. In 2018, and you can find these numbers online, the U.S. government killed more than 1.5 million wild animals, many at the request of farmers and ranchers in this program. When we turn to aquatic animals, we tend to have an interesting reaction. We may be okay paying people to kill fish on our behalf to eat them. I'd even argue that fishermen are kind of romanticized and mythologized, certainly in, you know, kind of the recent historical past, in literature, on film. I think quite romanticize them. But we do have an emotional reaction when we hear about the death of non-target species, whales, dolphins, turtles, porpoises, and birds, also known as bycatch. Bycatch refers to animals unintentionally caught and thus unwanted by the fishing industry. Commercial fishers use a number of techniques for ensnaring animals, from setting miles of line and baited hooks. So imagine just line, miles and miles of lines with baited hooks. These are called long lines, to catch animals such as sharks, swordfish, and tuna, to using large nets to catch schools of fish. So these are just some of the technologies used by the fishing industry. These large nets are towed underwater by what are called trawlers. A trawler is a fishing vessel designed for the purpose of operating a trawl, a type of fishing net that's dragged along the bottom of the sea. In just one pass, a trawl can remove up to 20% of the seafloor fauna and flora, and the fisheries with the highest levels of bycatch are shrimp fisheries. I used to love shrimp. I get it, but there's a problem. Shrimp are bottom dwellers, and so that's the only way to get them all in one fell swoop. And so as a result, 80 to 90% of a catch may consist of marine species other than the shrimp being targeted. In addition, dredging along the ocean floor also breaks up the coral and the habitats of bottom dwellers, other bottom dwellers. And because the same areas are dredged again and again and again, these habitats and inhabitants don't have time to recover before being destroyed again. Every year, an estimated 100 million sharks and rays are caught and discarded. Many sharks die as a result of tuna fisheries, which have also had a high level of dolphin bycatch. In addition to the millions of sharks we kill each year as bycatch, we also kill up to 73 million sharks for their fins alone for soup. Many sea turtles are listed as critically endangered and vulnerable. These are the different levels due to human behavior and commercial fishing, including leatherback sea turtles, the largest of all living turtles. They roam throughout the world's oceans, but their population is in decline. Habitat degradation, development, but longlining has also been a factor in accidentally killing several of the leatherback sea turtle specimens. According to studies, in the early 2000s, more than 250,000 loggerhead and 60,000 leatherback turtles are snared each year by commercial longline fishing. Tens of thousands of these turtles die. The study's authors estimate that 3.8 million hooks were set each day in 2000, a total of 1.4 billion hooks from 40 countries for the year. As a result, this was some good news. The federal government banned longlining in 2004. This is when George Bush was president, George W. Bush. When the Trump administration came along, they granted an exemption to two commercial fishing operations off the coast of California to allow for the use of longlining techniques again. Luckily, environmentalists quickly sued, saying the National Marine Fisheries Service failed to adequately account for how the reintroduction of longlining would affect the diminishing population of Pacific leatherback sea turtles. And luckily, a federal judge agreed and blocked the exemptions. But they're not out of the, you know, they're just, this is constant vigilance. We have to have constant vigilance. Another byproduct of the fishing industry is the brutal death of baby seals. Because of the overfishing of cod by the Canadian fishing industry in eastern Canada, in the Atlantic Ocean for Newfoundland's northeast coast, the cod population declined to such a degree that the Canadian government stepped in the late 1980s and imposed severe restrictions on commercial fishing. But it was too late. Because of overfishing, the fishery collapsed, never recovered, and the ecosystem changed such that it was no longer able to support codfish. So what does this have to do with seals? Scapegoating the seals for the collapse of the cod fisheries, fishermen demanded a kill. In 2003, the Canadian government bowed to pressure from the fishing industry and ordered the massacre of hundreds of thousands of seals, declaring war on the seals in hopes that massive seal kills would bring back the cod and keep their disgruntled fishermen working. In fact, cod is not a major food source of the harp seal and the hood seal diet. Nonetheless, during the three-year period of 2003 to 2005, the Canadian Department of Fisheries and Oceans allowed a kill quota of almost a million baby and adult harp seals and 30,000 adult hood seals. When the struck and lost seals are included, those are the ones who have been hit but lost in the waters, the total killed exceeds a million, making this the largest marine mammal slaughter in the world. According to the Humane Society of the United States, these kill levels are among the highest witnessed in Canada in half a century. The last time seals were killed at this rate, in the 1950s and the 1960s, the harp seal population was reduced by as much as two-thirds. Moreover, the actual number of seals killed is likely higher than the number reported. Many seals are shot at and injured in the course of the hunt, and studies suggest that a significant number of these animals slip beneath the surface of the water, or they die slowly and they're never recovered. Is that reason enough? Pick that reason. Pick that one. But there's more. Moving on to the environment. But first, I want to take a moment to thank my supporters, because I wouldn't be able to do this podcast without you. Thank you to everyone who goes over to Patreon, pauses this podcast, patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGaudreau, and supports this podcast. I don't know that people really think much about this, because they're not really thinking about me. They're thinking of their own lives and their own work. But I know that so many people want to know where to put their money, how to support, how to help animals in the most effective way. And there's so many nonprofits to pick from. There's so many good people, so many good organizations doing good work. But just because someone's a nonprofit doesn't necessarily mean they're doing the right work by the money that you donate. And just because someone is not a nonprofit doesn't mean they don't get donations. The main difference between a nonprofit and someone who doesn't have nonprofit status really is about taxes. You know, I pay taxes, nonprofits don't have to pay taxes. Now, because the idea is that they're doing good work to, you know, for the betterment of society, well, so are individual contributors. And so I'm just throwing that out there, because a lot of people who, even like me, who are individuals doing their own work, a lot of them are nonprofits. And so they have a fundraising machine, they have a staff, they have a whole team of people helping them. And I'm not saying that it should be the opposite, because I want to be able to do more work and be more effective and thus build a team. But it is just me. And I am really grateful. I have a very small, you know, a few hours a week that I have someone help me with emails and help me with some admin work. But I could do a lot more. And I, because of you, I'm able to do this work. So every dollar, I mean, 100% of the dollars that you send to me goes back into this work. So thank you. Go to patreon.com, become a supporter, Colleen Patrick Gaudreau. And thanks to the new patrons. We had some new patrons from the last episode. I mentioned this also recently. Becca Ann, Karen Windsor Levy, Rachel Henry, Joe Kiever, Amanda Campo, Bonnie Brandt, Diana Robles, Sabrina, and Grace Jimenez. And of course, my amazing, amazing, generous platinum supporters, Michal Stone, David Cabrera, Alexander Gray, Morgan Hall, and Brooke Bussard. All of you are so incredible. Like I said, all you need to do is go to patreon.com/Colleen Patrick Gaudreau. You put your credit card in, you look at the perks that you want in return for your support, and it just happens. It just goes on, and I will continue to do this work as long as I'm able. So thank you so much for your support. I'm so very grateful. So the environment, that's where we are now. While the majority of people self-identify as environmentalists, and the majority of people also eat animal flesh and fluids, the production of which is environmentally devastating, I'd say there's a bit of a disconnect there. However you look at it, raising animals for food is one of the leading causes of pollution and resource depletion today. The megatons of both liquid and solid animal waste should be enough to inspire self-described environmentalists to turn away from animal-based products. Contaminating the air, rivers, streams, and groundwater, animal urine and manure kill fish. They create noxious fumes and are major pollutants. According to a report by the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, 37% of the pesticides used in the United States as a whole are to grow crops for animals raised for human consumption. The livestock sector creates more greenhouse gas emissions than the transportation industry. We have heard this again and again. I know this probably sounds old, like old news. Listen to what Henning Steinfeld, chief of FAO's Livestock Information and Policy Branch and senior author of the report, wrote when the report was published. Quote, "Livestock are one of the most significant contributors to today's most serious environmental problems. Urgent action is required to remedy the situation." Is that a reason? Pick that reason. Eating locally sourced meat is what some people recommend as the solution. It does nothing to rectify the problem. The majority of the average household's carbon footprint doesn't come from transportation. That accounts for only 11%. It comes from preparation. And the preparation of meat is much more resource intensive than that of plant foods. So it's preparation. It's not transportation. It's preparation. And that is whether the animals were raised on a feedlot or raised, you know, as grass-fed. They still have to go to a feedlot. Of course they do. And of course they do. Or if they're, you know, again, labeled, marketed as grass-fed, but also locally sourced. I mean, that's really what a lot of people say, is they say they get locally sourced. So it's worth saying that about 75% to 80% of grass-fed, quote-unquote grass-fed beef sold in the U.S. is grown abroad, in Australia and in New Zealand and in parts of South America, according to a 2017 report from the Stone Barn Center for Food and Agriculture. Most of what comes from Australia is ground beef, not steaks, and many U.S. customers who want to support local food are unaware, usually unaware, of the foreign origin of most grass-fed beef, quote unquote. By law, if meat is processed, processed or passes through a USDA inspected plant, which is a requirement of for all imported beef, they have to go through USDA inspection, it can still be labeled as a product of the US. If it goes through USDA inspection, I'm just going to repeat that, and it does because all imported meat does, all imported beef does, it can be labeled as a product of the US, okay? Now, also regarding grass-fed animals, quote-unquote, there are numerous conflicting studies about whether it's better from an environmental perspective or not. One study, a Harvard report published in July of 2018 in the journal Environmental Research Letters, found that shifting U.S. beef production to exclusively grass-fed pastured systems would require 30% more cattle, of course, to keep up with the current demand and production levels. I mean, you cannot feed the same number of people eating beef using just a grass-fed system. You need more cattle in order to do that. And in doing that, the average methane footprint per unit of beef produced would likely increase by 43% due to the slower growth rates and higher methane conversion rates of grass-fed cattle. This would increase the U.S.'s total methane emissions by approximately 8%, according to the researchers. Is that a reason? Pick that reason. But if that's not enough, consider the following. It's several times more efficient for humans to eat grains directly than to funnel them through farmed animals. We've heard this for decades, both in terms of the water used and the total outcome produced. Petroleum oil fuels the thousands of miles of transportation. It's lower than the production of animal products, but that's still a factor. So you're adding both the high emissions from just producing animal products, and you're also adding the transportation emissions. So you've got the transportation, the feedlot, the slaughterhouse, the meatpacking plant, the supermarket. You have all of those that are fueled by petroleum oil. Overfishing has depleted biodiversity in the oceans, and because aquafarms dump waste, pesticides, and other chemicals into ecologically fragile coastal waters, local ecosystems are destroyed, devastating animals and plants on both the land and the water. So we can keep trying to squeeze our ethics into some like unethical hypothetical scenario, or we can just not eat the stuff. We can pick that reason. Then we have overpopulation, and I'm not talking about overpopulation of humans, although that is indeed a factor in all of this, because the more people we have on the planet, the more people who want to eat meat, of course, the more people who are, the more animals we bring into this world only to kill. What I'm referring to, though, right now is overpopulation of livestock, of the animals we bring into this world only to kill: pigs, chickens, cattle, goats, turkeys, etc. Now, I don't know if this blows your mind the way it blows my mind, but I'm going to read it to you anyway. There are over 100 billion farmed animals alive at this moment, more than 10 times the number of humans. More than 10 times. What's more is over 90%, right? Over 90% of these animals, and 99% in the US, but 90% worldwide of these animals live on industrial, large-scale factory farms, enduring atrocious cruelty, such as intense confinement in tiny cages, brutal mutilation and slaughter methods, and rampant health issues from artificial breeding, right? This is why I say, when people say, but I only get free, no, you don't. Like, the majority of animals raised for human consumption are raised in these conditions. What's more, clearing all of the land needed to house and pasture so many cattle, sheep, chickens, pigs, and other farmed animals, and to grow crops to feed them, clearing all of that land has led to livestock production becoming the single greatest driver of wildlife habitat loss and destruction globally. Now, I mentioned the intentional killing of wild animals to protect ranchers, but this is in addition to that. This is about the land we've given over to livestock and taken away from native wildlife. Let me read you a bit of Yuval Noah Harari's foreword to Clean Meat, How Growing Meat Without Animals Will Revolutionize Dinner and the World. You would have heard me talk to Paul Shapiro on this episode and on the Animology episode about this, but Yuval wrote the foreword to Paul's book. And oh, what a way to start a book. Here you go. We imagine that the earth is populated by lions, elephants, and penguins roaming freely across vast savannas and oceans. That may be true of the National Geographic Channel, Disney movies, and children's fairy tales, but it's no longer true of the real world outside the TV screen. The world contains 40,000 lions and 1 billion domesticated pigs, 500,000 elephants, and 1.5 billion domesticated cows, 50 million penguins, and 50 billion chickens, a figure that excludes male chicks and unproductive hens killed in egg production. Nearly 1.5 billion pigs are killed to feed the growing appetite for pork, bacon, ham, and sausages, a number that has tripled in the last 50 years. Half a billion sheep are taken to the abattoir every year. In 2009, a census counted 1.6 billion wild birds in Europe, including all species together, 1.6 billion wild birds. That same year, the European meat and egg industry raised close to 7 billion chickens. A large portion of vertebrate animals living on our planet are no longer free living, but rather are owned and controlled by one animal, Homo sapiens. And so, to summarize, livestock production is a leading cause of climate change, soil loss, water and nutrient pollution, and decreases of apex predators and wild herbivores, compounding pressures on ecosystems and biodiversity. Maybe that's not reason enough. After all, environmental issues are hard to personalize and quantify, and people don't see the problems associated with them unless they impact them directly. And so what's the most immediate and personal environment that we feel the most directly? Our bodies, right? So consider that an environment that is being polluted, and it is. For some people, the direct effects of meat, dairy, and eggs on their health are what compel them to turn to a plants-only diet. As rates of heart disease, cancer, diabetes, hypertension, and other life-threatening conditions skyrocket in the United States. And remember my podcast episode from probably a decade ago called The Diseases of Civilization. This is not a name that I give them. It's a name that was given to them by doctors. These are the diseases of civilization. Doesn't sound very civilized. Many researchers and medical experts come to the same conclusion. A plant-based diet can help protect your health and even reverse some diseases, including the most common one, heart disease. Plant-based diets offer a number of nutritional benefits, including lower levels of saturated fat, cholesterol, and animal protein, as well as higher levels of carbohydrates, complex carbohydrates, which are necessary. We need complex carbohydrates, fiber, magnesium, potassium, folate, and antioxidants such as vitamin C, E, and phytochemicals. According to the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, which was formerly the American Dietetic Association, vegetarians, we've heard this before, have been reported to have lower body mass indexes than non-vegetarians, as well as lower rates of death from ischemic heart disease. Vegetarians also show lower blood cholesterol levels, lower blood pressure, and lower rates of hypertension, type 2 diabetes, prostate, and colon cancer. Is that a reason? Pick that reason. How about this? We have no dearth of food on this planet. What we do have is a highly political food system, an inequitable distribution system, and a worldwide increase in the consumption of meat, animal milk, and eggs. Almost 1 billion people in the world are starving, and a significant culprit is the animal agriculture system. By now, most people have heard that it can take up to 15 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of edible animal flesh, a pretty wasteful conversion. What's more, because raising animals for human consumption creates a demand for crops that will be fed to farmed animals, animal agriculture is responsible for topsoil loss, soil erosion, and deforestation. More than half of the world's corn crop and more than 80% of its soybean crop are fed to farmed animals. Did you hear that number? 80% of its soybean crop. That'd be a lot of tofu. There'd be a lot of tofu, a lot of tempeh, a lot of yuba. Because that is such an exorbitant amount of waste of food calories. Even a 10% drop in U.S. meat consumption would make a huge difference in terms of food available to feed the world's starving millions. So human rights might be reason enough for you. If not, what about systemic violence? We have been taught to compartmentalize animals into those we eat, those who entertain us, those whose fur we take, those who we keep in our homes, and so on. The social framework that has divided up animals enables us to justify exploiting some but admiring and loving others. Most people would never think of killing the mourning doves they watch from their windows, or the geese they feed at the park, or the coyotes they glimpse in the wild, or the deer they admire. But because of our habits that are formed and perpetuated not out of necessity, but out of familiarity, billions of animals are brought into this world solely to be killed. Some are used up for years before they're sent to slaughter, but in the end, all are bred for the same purpose, to be used by humans and for humans and experience the same end, slaughter at a young age. Not only is it not necessary, there is also nothing natural about animal agriculture. It is the antithesis of nature. Breeding animals only to kill them is absurd at best, and killing animals when they're babies is standard, whether they're raised conventionally or in operations labeled humane, sustainable, natural, free-range, local, organic, cage-free, heritage-bred, grass-fed, or poetry-read. Someone sent that to me once. That one's not an official term used. But it highlights the romanticism with which animal agriculture is marketed and regarded. So, when we take into account each one of the animals and each type of species we bring into this world, this is what we find. Dairy cows endure a constant cycle of pregnancy, loss, and forced lactation until their bodies are so worn out and depleted of calcium that they're sent to slaughter at 4 or 5 years young. Beef cattle reach slaughter age by 24 months young. These are babies. Cattle can live 20 years or more. 33 million cattle were bred and slaughtered in the U.S. in 2018, 3,201,000 of which were dairy cows. Male calves born to dairy cows have no purpose in an industry that exploits the female reproductive system. And so they're killed anytime between 1 day young and 24 weeks young to be sold as veal. 580,300 veal calves were bred and killed in the U.S. in 2018. Pigs can live up to 12 years, but they're slaughtered at 6 months young. Breeding sows, who are kept to simply birth the babies who will be killed in 6 months, are killed when they're between 3 and 5 years young. Again, they could live up to 12. After giving birth to and losing dozens of offspring, 124,400,000 hogs were bred and killed in the U.S. in 2018, 3,358,800 of whom were sows. Chickens bred and kept for their flesh are slaughtered around 7 weeks young. Chickens bred and kept for their eggs are killed around 1 to 2 years young. Chickens can live up to 8 years, and I'm giving these as pretty low averages for their lifespan. But of course, don't forget that a lot of the animals I'm talking about are already artificially, they're manipulated. Their genes are manipulated, and so they already have a lot of problems. So what I'd love to do is compare what the ancestors of these animals, how long they would have lived in the wild. So these are approximate numbers because, of course, chickens can live longer than that. But 8 years would be the average, and it really depends on which industry they come from, because the chickens who are bred for their meat are manipulated in ways that are different than those who are raised for their eggs. But in both cases, it's pretty grim. So they could live up to 8 years. In 2018, 9 billion 160,910,000 chickens were bred and killed in the US. 9 billion. As you can see, the majority of animals who are killed in our animal agriculture system are chickens. So when anybody says, and I have a podcast episode called I Eat Only Chickens, that they eat only chickens, this is something to consider. Pick that reason. Chickens are classified as poultry, a category that's not protected under the so-called Humane Slaughter Act, meaning they don't have to be stunned unconscious before having their throats cut. So 9 billion of these animals, and you know, 9 billion plus of these animals who are raised to be killed, the majority of these animals are not under the Humane Slaughter Act. Turkeys are killed when they're 4 to 5 months young, though they have a lifespan of up to 15 years. 236,660,000 turkeys were bred and killed in 2018. And turkeys are also classified as poultry in the industry, so they are also not included under the Humane Slaughter Act, even though it's poorly enforced. It doesn't apply to them either. Ducks are slaughtered when they're 7 to 8 weeks young, though they have a lifespan of between 6 and 8 years. 27,640,000 were bred and killed in 2018. Ducks are also classified as poultry, so the Humane Slaughter Act doesn't protect them either. Geese are slaughtered at between 15 and 20 weeks young, and geese can live between 8 and 15 years. Geese were among the 196,852,000 pounds of birds, excluding chickens and turkeys, bred and slaughtered in the U.S. in 2018. Since they're also classified as poultry, the Humane Slaughter Act does not apply to geese. Goats are killed between 12 and 20 weeks young, although they can live up to 14 years. 731,800 goats were slaughtered in 2018, according to the USDA. All of these numbers are according to the USDA. You can find them online in the USDA database. Rabbits are slaughtered at 10 to 12 weeks young, though their natural lifespan is 8 to 12 years. Approximately 2 million rabbits were killed. That number is a little harder to find. And ironically, rabbits are classified as poultry, so the Humane Slaughter Act does not apply to them. Lambs are slaughtered at 6 to 8 months young, though the lifespan of sheep is 12 to 14 years. 2,260,000 lambs and sheep were bred and killed in the U.S. in 2018. 2,140,000 of which were lambs and yearlings. So the majority of the of those animals we kill are babies, even more babies than the babies. Squab pigeons sold for consumption in many U.S. restaurants. I know it's so crazy because I just don't even think about this and the kinds of animals and all these different animals. Squab pigeons are killed for many U.S. restaurants and they're slaughtered at 4 weeks young. The lifespan of these king pigeons is 8 to 12 years. Pigeons were among the 121,800,000 pounds of birds that I had mentioned about geese, excluding chickens and turkeys, that were bred and slaughtered in the U.S. in 2018. While horses have not been slaughtered domestically since 2007, nearly 138,000 horses were transported to Canada and Mexico. This was back in 2010 for slaughter, and this just keeps going back and forth between the federal government. Horses can naturally live into their 30s, but it's young, healthy horses who are often slaughtered. And of course, if you're interested in more about horses and how they are demonized because of the animal agriculture industry, that is a whole other topic. And we will cover that in a separate episode, specifically around the Bureau of Land Management and the killing of wild horses in wild burrows, again, at the behest of ranchers to protect the ranging land for cattle, not for indigenous, native, wild animals. When it comes to seafood, the number of individual fish and shellfish is almost impossible to calculate. 150 million tons of seafood was produced for human consumption in 2016. Nearly half of that is from aquaculture, for example, trout and shrimp farms, rather than caught in fisheries. So that's usually quantified in terms of weight rather than individual animals. So pick that reason. If not, violence against all of these billions of animals, that is what is so striking. Yes, it's mechanized. Yes, it's industrialized, but you still need human beings to do the killing. So if violence against animals isn't enough to convince you, then remember that violence does not exist in a vacuum. In order to make it possible to kill animals every second of every day, we need labor. We need real humans to partake. And as such, we have created a culture of violence. Workers who labor in animal factories and slaughterhouses suffer from repetitive stress injuries, as well as respiratory illnesses due to exposure to such gases as ammonia from animal feces and urine, and hydrogen sulfide from manure pits. The fast line speeds, the dirty killing floors, the lack of training, and the struggling animals who break workers' bones, cut, and sometimes trample them make slaughterhouses some of the most dangerous places to work in America today. What's more, those who make a living killing on whatever size farm and for whatever purpose become desensitized to violence against animals and people, including loved ones. Much more work needs to be done in this area, but sociologists are beginning to document the rates of domestic abuse, alcoholism, and violent crime among slaughterhouse workers and in those areas where slaughterhouses exist. According to the Food Empowerment Project, a leader in raising awareness about human rights and the animal farming industry, quote, a large percentage of factory farm workers are people of color, including migrant workers from Mexico and other parts of Latin America. An unknown percentage of full-time and part-time workers are undocumented. Employers find undocumented workers to be ideal recruits because they're less likely to complain about low wages and hazardous working conditions. Workers are largely unaware of the inherent health hazards and social struggles they'll encounter in this industry. Differences in language and culture often leave workers feeling like outcasts in their new community, end quote. Pick that reason. Pick that reason, pick any reason, and it alone would justify consuming plants over animals. There are still many misconceptions about vegans who do it for the animals, and it is a joy to debunk them whenever I can. However, one that leaves me really sad is the assumption that because I care about this issue, violence against animals, I don't care about other issues. That in caring about animals, I don't care about humans, as if compassion for one species means lack of compassion for another. The implication is that we humans have a limited capacity for mercy, kindness, and empathy, that we don't have enough to go around. And though I don't believe people have a limited capacity for compassion, I do think our innate childhood compassion gets dulled by the many ways in which our society values convenience, pleasure, and convention above everything else. Free of the expectations imposed on us by societal mores and cultural traditions, we would discover that our hearts are large enough to hold everyone. Indeed, the more we give, the more we have to go around. What good could possibly come from parceling out our compassion in a piecemeal fashion or creating boundaries around it? Where should these boundaries end? At different races, at different genders, at different species? Should we ration our compassion? Silly as that concept sounds, it seems to be the implication when people judge others for caring about animals. I have said this before. I know for sure that the problems we have in this world are not because we have so much compassion we don't know what to do with it. The problems we have in this world are because people are not living according to their own values of compassion and kindness and manifesting that in their everyday lives. The problem is not the people who are doing something in this world. There are a lot of issues to address. There is a lot of work to be done, and there are millions of people doing absolutely nothing. Would that more people got up, spoke out, and did something, anything, to make this world better for everyone? The problem is not a few people who do a lot on behalf of animals. The problem is the many people who do nothing for no one. And the fact is, any work that focuses on creating nonviolence and kindness in this world affects all other types of social issues. They're all connected. We are of our society. Compassionate people all have the same goal. Whoever is the recipient of that goal, the elimination of oppression, the elimination of exploitation, the elimination of violence, abuse, violence, and cruelty all spring from the same source, and they all have the same effect: more abuse, more violence, more cruelty. And there's a beautiful quote in Milan Kundera's novel, The Unbearable Lightness of Being. It goes, "Humanity's true moral test, its fundamental test, consists of its attitude toward those who are at his mercy, animals. And in this respect, humankind has suffered a fundamental debacle, a debacle so fundamental that all others stem from it." Pick a reason, any reason, whatever brings us to not eat animals and eat only plants, the benefits we experience and that everyone else experience are manifold, and they cast ripple effects far beyond what we can imagine, far beyond what we can even see. Just because we can't see it doesn't mean it's not happening. Just because we can't see it and measure it and touch it doesn't mean it isn't the right thing to do. And knowing that, picking your reason, finding your reason, and knowing there are multiple reasons, finding that reason, manifesting that reason, tastes better than any burger, any chicken nugget, any fish fillet I've ever had. Pick a reason, any reason, for the animals. This is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. Thank you for listening.